Hello again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time. I am the great Brian Last, and as always, with me, Sheedy Award winner, David Bixenspan.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. You okay over there?
We pose a question of some kind to the other person, whether it's how are you doing or something else.
So
you just went at me cold.
Tell me about the social stratification in Brazil.
I know there are a lot of favelas. I know that Jose Aldo grew up in one. I know that there's a bad economy there right now. Because even if you don't hear about it in the news, if you watch UFC, the Brazilian fighters always cut really, really long promos about it. So,
well, other than UFC, are there any great professional wrestlers from Brazil? Who am I missing?
Ted Boy Marino.
Who else? Are there any great professional wrestlers?
That one Ted Boy Marino match that's online is really good.
I'm not all that familiar with Ted Boy Marino.
You should look it up. Remember, he passed a few years ago, and Meltzer wrote the obituary, and it says it's this sort of lucha type style with this guy who looks like Jerry Jarrett, but like a handsomer Jerry Jarrett.
Okay, I am now intrigued. I will definitely check this out.
Okay,
there's our first video for the playlist, Alan Blackstock.
Yeah, so I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Bix. So, we had a lot of interesting things on the show last week. What are your you have any thoughts a week out from the previous episode?
Yeah, the feedback to everything was really good. I mean, it seemed like people were really intrigued by the Mario Galento and Jack Donovan stuff. We also got some good response to the interesting new career of the one and only Dark Journey.
Bix.
Yes?
Did someone mention a Dark Journey?
Yes, I did. How are you doing, man?
Have you figured out who I am yet?
Could I get a clue?
The beach. 1986. Tulsa.
There are no beaches in Tulsa.
Also 1986. That's separate.
Where is this beach in Tulsa?
Would you like to have an example of my black magic?
Sure. This sounds fun. Now, can I ask you a question, though, about Tulsa in 1986?
Yes.
Did you meet Dark Journey when you were in Tulsa in 1986? Not a Dark Journey, the Dark Journey.
Remember the hose. Remember.
Hey, Black Scorpion.
Yes.
Did your grandmother have a bowel management program?
Dark Journey has a special for wrestling fans from Puerto Rico. The Carlos Colonic. Hey.
Yes?
How did Carlos Colon get into the Hall of Fame, but not Ole Anderson? Black magic. This always starts so well, and then we never know where we're going or how to end it.
Pretty much. Did you ever notice you sound a lot like the Shockmaster?
I actually... I'm Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget. I'll get you, Sting.
Next time?
Bix.
Okay, I think we've had enough.
How did Ole Anderson not have to have, like, throat lozenges, like, all the time? I do that thing for, like, a minute, and I'm ready to die.
Jeez. That was terrible.
How did it start? How did Ole start doing that voice?
That was what was in his head for the Black Scorpion, I guess.
The Black Scorpion. Well, yeah, the Dark Journey stuff was interesting, to say the least. We did have one suggestion that we should try to get her on the show, although I'm not sure how she would react to our constant laughter at her grandmother's bowel management if she listened to the episode from last week.
That's true. Maybe she'd take it in jest and just realize that maybe she just wasn't good at putting in words what she was trying to say. I hope.
Yeah. Maybe instead of Dark Journey, we should get Missy Hyatt on the show and just talk to her about wrestling. Because actually, when she was on Jim Cornette's show, she was really, really good.
She was great.
Yeah. And we should talk to her about wrestling and just out of nowhere, kind of P.B. Diezer, be like, well, we want to send you a link. Can you please read this on the air and just send her the link and have her see what Dark Journey's up to?
Well, she follows me on Twitter now, so we'll see.
Ask her. Let's try to get Missy Hyatt.
Okay.
Missy Hyatt or Bruno Sammartino?
Okay. I'll email Chris Cruz, I guess.
Yeah. No, I don't want Bruno. I mean, no, it would be great, but I don't know. Dave Meltzer does that enough. Plus, you know, every Bruno interview ends up, you know, I don't want to brag, but I was selling out everywhere, and they call me back. They said, Bruno, come back. And Vince asked me to go on tour with his druggies, and I said, you need me to go to every club. You need every club sold out. Send me to the club. And Vince said, Bruno, we haven't called them a club since 1962.
Well, he's okay. He's okay with going to the bigger clubs.
Yeah. Yeah. The bigger clubs.
Doesn't Bruno have a good knock-knock joke?
The old knock-knock joke, and it's not relevant anymore because Bruno...
Should we credit... Are we allowed... Or is this a kayfabe thing, the person who came up with this knock-knock joke?
I'll credit who I heard it from, who I think everyone heard it from. Bill Apter used to tell this to everyone. I don't know where he first heard it from, but Bill Apter used to tell this joke. It was Bruno Sammartino telling a knock-knock joke during the years where he was estranged from the World Wrestling Federation. And I'll be Bruno, you be Mr. Knock-Knock.
You better be Bruno.
Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Vince.
Vince who?
Vince who destroyed professional wrestling. Vince who took my son David and gave him steroids. And on and on and on and on. You just keep going with Vince who did this, Vince who did that. The boogeyman, Vince McMahon. It's amazing how it all changed. You know, as soon as he went to the Hall of Fame, he's now, you know, oh, I know Joseph Maroon, and I know they're testing for drugs, and I know that, yeah.
Well, that was one of the reasons he was willing, though, was that Maroon was his back surgeon.
Maroon's having a great year. There are guys on the roster of World Wrestling Entertainment who I think are clearly on some sort of substance. And he's now depicted in a movie as being the NFL's patsy doctor denying concussions.
Yes.
But anyway, we're talking too much about current stuff. Yes, just in that one sentence right there. So what's going on, Bix? What's on your mind?
I don't know. I realize I do need to catch up on NWA Classics, especially after seeing what they put up today. The day we're recording this, which is Dick Murdoch versus Terry Gordy.
Wow.
And even more intriguing because I was trying to think, like, when would it be from? Because they were, like, if it was Mid-South, they were only there together in 87 after Crockett took over. And then that wouldn't have been Houston anyway because Bosch would have been out of, you know.
Bosch left. That's right.
And then I think, like, did he bring one in while the other was there? No. It's from October 8th, 1982, when – and he was still primarily getting his talent from Joe Blanchard. I mean, Paul Bosch was. And, you know, he had Junkyard Dog coming in at that point, though. So I'm going to guess he just brought Murdoch in via Mid-South and brought in Gordy off Georgia TV.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it would be. I'm not sure if the Freebirds, other than Michael Hayes, were in Dallas yet or doing anything in Dallas yet. The Dallas card for that night is pretty unappealing to me. Ken Mantell defeated Frank Dusick. Checkmate over Samu. Magic Dragon over Roberto Renesto. David Von Erich, DQ victory over Wild Bill Irwin. And Al Madrill and Bugsy McGraw in the main event, defeating Great Kabuki and Gary Hart.
Oof. Well.
Oof. Yeah, I don't know if I don't know exactly. I mean, it's an interesting thing. When we were trying to figure it out, we were thinking that, you know, this is just a few months before Southwest would go completely outlaw and run against Bosch in Houston at the Summit and crown their own world champion, Adrian Adonis.
Right.
Tournament final over Cowboy Bob Orton, given a belt that Terry Funk had made for himself and also presented, although not really, with Luthez's Classic Championship belt. A really good match, too. I got that from PM Film. Many, many years ago. And also on that show was the breakup of the fight between the dynamic duo, Tully against Gino. And then that kind of died right away because I think Gino left. And this is a mere months before that. I think Bosch went full time to Mid-South Talent in, I want to say, beginning of 83. So that's only a couple months before this. He was already using Junkyard Dog on these shows as he was an attraction. And on this show, it's that has Gordy versus Murdoch. It's Tony Atlas and the JYD versus the Dynamic Duo. But yeah, this is the end of Southwest's relationship with Paul Bosch.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember, was it a thing where they just weren't drawing that well and it was JYD who was drawing, so we just switched to Mid-South? It was something like that, right?
Well, I think it was also he was having a lot of issues with Tully as the booker for Blanchard.
Yes.
I believe that's what I heard. And he wouldn't be unique in having issues with Tully.
No.
But I believe that was a large part of it. You know, I actually just recently I have a really good collection of wrestling books. And obviously, if you listen to the show in past weeks, we've talked about different books that have come out. And that's something we're going to continue to do.
Both good and bad.
Especially if you get your book in our hands, we will definitely read it and go over it on the air and plug the hell out of you. So send us books. One book I don't have that I've always wanted was Hey Boy, Where'd You Get the Mirrors by Paul Bosch.
I actually have a copy of that now.
I never had a copy of it. I first heard about it. Dave Meltzer had written that he had a copy of it years and years and years ago, when I think the only person outside of Dave who had it was like very, very few people and Valerie Bosch, Paul's widow. And I'm reading a review of this online, and apparently there is some kayfabe and stuff in there still, but it says that you can order a trade paperback copy from the Minutemen Press in Houston, Texas. So I may have to check that out.
I don't think it was printed on demand, though. I think it was just that the local Minuteman Press was where they had the book printed.
I wonder if there's still copy. That's one of those few books that I need for my collection.
Yeah, I should. I've been thinking about. Yeah, I talked to someone about it. To see if there's a way to get it, like do like a non-destructive scan of it somewhere, if there's anywhere that would be not too expensive.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that might be worth doing, but I don't know. We'll see.
I'd love to see. What is it, like 370 pages?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the manuscript Meltzer had, because he took out some of his feelings on, like, especially, you know, then-current wrestling, which was 89 when he wrote it. But it's interesting. I mean, he's very thorough, kind of, and he goes over, like, different things in the business that don't even directly affect him. I mean, it's a fun read. I haven't read it, like, all the way through. I've just kind of, like, paged through it at different points, but I've read a lot of it. It's just it's interesting. It's fun. I mean, I wish we had the full version.
Right.
But I'm guessing that's never going to happen unless, maybe, I should ask Bruce Tharp, since he navigated the whole everyone fighting over the tapes.
You should. You know, one of the things I really want to read in there is that Bosch wrote a good deal about the dissolution of his relationship with Bill Watts in his office. I really want to read that stuff.
Yeah, one of the things I remember was that, like, when he decided to set up the deal with the WWF, how professional they were. They flew someone to Houston to get him the first tape of the TV show so he could just run it as soon as possible on his next TV.
Wow.
And he was impressed by that, but then everything else happened with the no-shows. And then
everything fell apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bosch's retirement show was the show that led to Jim Duggan getting a second chance.
Yes. I've heard two different versions of the story over the years. Once that match surfaced on Classics On Demand, it was easier to figure out which was true. Because, you know, he got fired with the whole Iron Sheik, you know, drug bust thing. And then because Bosch got to pick, I think it was literally like anyone that wasn't working for Crockett Promotions, Vince was letting him bring in, right?
Well, on the show, I think at Mil Máscaras, Bruno was obviously there.
Terry Funk.
Was Terry Funk there?
Okay, Terry Funk worked Chavo Guerrero, which I believe is the only match on the show that's not on tape. That's not available on tape.
Okay. I know he had like in attendance Ernie Ladd, Vern, Luthez.
Yeah, Vern was there, though.
Boris Malenko. Yeah. Stu Hart, who we know he has a relationship with from our hometown of Long Beach, New York, where Bosch was the chief of lifeguards and Stu Hart was spending his time, and that's where he met Helen Smith, who became Helen Hart.
Yep. What else?
I didn't realize that Classics on Demand aired any of that. I didn't realize they had any of the footage from that late.
Well, because it's WWE, though. So it's that's what they, you know what I mean? That's what they
oh, you mean WWE? You mean WWE Classics?
Yes, WWE Classics.
I thought you meant NWA Classics.
No. No, that, so anyway, as far as Duggan, so he brought Duggan back in to work with DiBiase because that had been such a big feud. And I forget if Duggan got injured right before the match or he got injured like at the beginning of the match, but what was it, like something bad, like one of those really painful things, like torn abdominal muscle, I think?
Yeah, that's right.
And he just gutted it through the match, and that got him his job back. Because I had heard once that it was, I feel like I'd heard for years that it was, that he had such a great match that it got him rehired, but it was more just that he gutted it through. And if you watch it, it's not really a good match, but it's impressive that he gets through it. I pulled up, so you've got in attendance, people who were there included Red Bastien, Tiger Conway Sr., Vern Gagne, Stu Hart, Gene Kaniski, Ernie Ladd, Jose Lothario, Bronco Lubitsch, Billy Red Lions, Boris Malenko, Vince McMahon, Sputnik Monroe, Pat Patterson, Luthez, and Jack Tunney.
Sputnik Monroe, wow.
Yeah, and the results were Sam Houston over Steve Lombardi, Bruno Sammartino over Hercules Hernandez, second from the bottom. Brutus Beefcake over Johnny Valiant in the hair match. Actually, wait, so that was on the that was on that Coliseum video, The Most Embarrassing Moments or whatever, so I guess that was sort of existed before the Classics on Demand thing. Tom Pritchard over Mark Lewin in an interesting match.
Yeah. Interesting that Pritchard went over.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a matter of like what
being
the hometown guy or Lewin thinking highly of him or just all of the above. Hogan and One Man Gang. What was it that it was maybe a double DQ or something? Because I don't see.
Well, One Man Gang had just been a major star for Houston for a while. Yeah.
Right. And he and Gang was involved in the Ted DiBiase Houston only heel turn that they did to explain the Million Dollar Man thing.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's right.
Sherry Martel beat Fabulous Moolah, which was a rematch of Sherry winning the title on her WWF debut, which no one really remembers, and I guess it's more of an indicator of what the AWA or the state of the AWA at the time. Sherry was still the AWA champion when she started with WWF, and she won the title on her debut. So she technically held both titles at the same time.
I never knew that.
Yeah. Junkyard Dog and Tony Atlas beat Sika and Kamala. Terry Funk beat Chavo Guerrero.
That's interesting. This show right here that we were just looking at, October 8th, 82, yeah, also had Tony Atlas and JYD teaming up.
That's right.
Against the Dynamic Duo.
Yeah, Ted DiBiase over Jim Duggan. And the show closer was Mil Máscaras and Tito Santana over Demolition by DQ. And Classics on Demand has a Mil Máscaras. Not Classics on Demand. NWA Classics has a Tito and Máscaras match that went up recently, and it is them against Mass Superstar and Super Destroyer, which actually sounds really good.
So it's basically everyone in the match except for Super Destroyer.
Oh yeah! Wow! I wonder if that's by design or something that they.
Hey, that show, that Paul Bosch retirement show, is that, you think that's the first time Vince and Vern were in the same room together since '84?
I would think so.
Yeah.
And then Vince was still screwing with him till the end.
Yeah, well, he never stopped doing that.
The pettiness of it was pretty amazing, though. The state that Vern was in from 87 to the end, that his promotion was in.
You can never say that Vern and his organization isn't petty based on what they've done then and what they do now.
But they never – what other totally dead promotion did they just – make a conscious effort to raid and screw with?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that they, because, you know, when Vince goes national, AWA is huge. AWA is having their best year ever in 1983. And it's just huge. And it's has more territory, more actual land that it covers than any other territory in the country.
Right. Cause they have all the metros in the Midwest, and I think at that point they had added Salt Lake and San Francisco.
Do you think Vince and his, do you think Vince followed them enough to know that they were in dire straits, or Vince just always saw them as their competition until they're gone?
Because they had those, they were based out of those major metros in the Midwest, you think?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they were the only other wrestling group to go with action figures. onto the marketplace. Now, again, they weren't the greatest, but still, they had the Remco action figures out there when he had his LJN action figures.
They had the cheap videos in stores, at toy stores and stuff.
They had a cable television deal.
Yes.
They were in Vegas. I mean, maybe...
Well, the cable thing... Yeah, the cable thing was sort of like how things were this past year, too. With all the stuff with, you know, oh, ROH is on national cable, is on cable now? Whoa, no.
Look what they did. I mean, I don't want to go too deep into this on this program, but look what they did in New Japan. New Japan on Access was my favorite wrestling show that currently aired, and they rated Mauro Ranallo, Shinsuke Nakamura, AJ Styles. You know, I watched Lucha Azteca on TV. They got La Sombra. I mean, they're just every show I enjoy, they're going after the people I like. So they could give them all stupid names and, you know.
I guess we should be glad that Rush is too short.
I'm looking on the results for that 82 show because that Dallas show, the Sportatorium, was awful. I'm trying to see where Kevin and Kerry were. I don't see them working anywhere else that night. Could be just a result I don't have.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, and by the way, so when we were looking for that result, we found, like, I don't think Chris Zellner updates this anymore. Like, he had started a message board where he was posting results years ago. Like, when were these posted? This is 2012. Ah, okay. I don't remember it being that recent. But we're looking, and it's if anyone wants to see it, it's called Wide World Wrestling, wideworldwrestling.proboards.com. And I don't know. I thought it would be a little fun just for a couple minutes before we get down to further business to look at the stuff that happened, I guess, 35 years ago on the anniversary of the day this comes out, which is January 7th. Let's see.
Happy anniversary, Bix.
What? I don't know. I mean, the WWF show is a WWF high school show. I don't think we need to dignify that.
The interesting thing that
ICW.
ICW had a split crew. The PAFO ICW had a split crew running two different towns in Kentucky on January 7th, 1981. One town main evented by Lanny PAFO and, well, I don't know if that was the main event. The card was, it's only four matches, Joe Bannock versus Tennessee Stud. I guarantee that's not a Fuller.
I guarantee you he's a job guy that always lost under a mask.
Yeah, exactly. Buddy Landell, before he bleached his hair, versus the Miser. Bob Orton Jr.
Well, tell everyone who the Miser was.
The Miser?
Yes.
Was the Black Scorpion.
No.
No, he was Angelo PAFO doing a play on the fact that he was tight with a buck. So they made him the Miser.
Yes.
He made himself the Miser, quite frankly.
Yes.
Bob Orton Jr. versus Pistol Pez Whatley. And then in the main event for the U.S. Tag Team titles, Lanny PAFO and George Weingroff, one of the few legally blind professional wrestlers.
And one of your favorite against wrestlers.
Against Jeff Swords. Jeff Sword and Doug Vines, the Devil's Duo.
Devil's Duo and was a very good team.
They were all right for that group.
And then later,
by Izzy Slapowitz?
I believe so. And then later they were in Memphis, too.
Okay. Oh, that's right. I do remember that. That was in Carrollton, Kentucky. In Monticello, Kentucky, Wayne Davis versus Big Boy Williams.
I have no idea.
Enough wrestlers named Big Boy anymore.
Yeah.
Debbie Combs versus Donna Day.
Now, remind everyone who Debbie Combs' boyfriend was at this point in time.
At this time, Debbie Combs was the live-in girlfriend of Randy Macho Man Savage.
Yep.
Hence, her being the woman wrestler for the PAFO family organization.
Yes.
And then in the semi-main event, the Black Avenger and Rip Rogers versus Danny Doyle and Rick McCord. I'd like to know who the Black Avenger is. And then in the main event for the ICW heavyweight title, the champion Ron Garvin versus Randy Macho Man Savage.
Which I'm sure, even on a spot show, I'm sure is really good.
I'm sure that was great.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was really, really great. That's one of the saddest things, you know, when it comes to tape trading. There isn't more, not just the ICW television show, but just Randy Savage from that era. I remember Jim Cornette telling me that Randy Savage and Bobby Eaton. Like in 78 or so.
Oh, yeah, 90-minute draws or whatever the hell it was.
Oh, they were just beating the hell out of each other every night, coming off the top rope, doing all sorts of things that they would later do when their bodies are already beaten up, but just doing it when they're young and energetic. For Nick Lewis, I would assume. Oh, I would kill to see those matches.
So something I noticed with that main event in Carrollton with Lanny and Juan Groff against the Devil's Duo, presumably with Izzy Slapowitz. Evil Jew manager against team of two guys who were at least half Jewish.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Did ICW employ more members of the tribe than any other wrestling group at that time?
If we're counting, I don't know. Like, I don't know. No, wait. Was Angela the Jewish one?
No, Angela's wife. Angela's wife. Angela.
So they are Jewish then. If Judy's Jewish, then they're Jewish.
I mean, I personally believe that if either one of your parents are Jewish, you're Jewish. But I know that it's supposed to be if the mother's Jewish.
I know in the terminology that people use about that. So they're Jewish, and Weingroff is at least half Jewish. Even if they weren't practicing, they're Jewish. So
isn't Pezwatwe Jewish?
Sure.
boy, you don't go along with any of my jokes, Bix.
Well, then didn't he convert to something else when he became Shaska?
Now that's just ridiculous. You know what's interesting? I just noticed on here the day before, January 6, 1981, in Oakland for Roy Shire, the opening match is Rip Hawk beating Art Dominguez. I didn't know Rip Hawk was still working in 1981.
No. And because who was he booking talent from in 80? Is this?
Well, here's the card. I mean, there's only four matches listed here.
Yeah, I'm looking at this and I have no idea who he was getting the talent.
Magnificent Morocco versus Tony Rocco. That's two people with Rocco in their name there. Mike York over Moondog Moretti, and then Pampero Firpo won Battle Royal. Is that the annual Battle Royal? Was the annual Battle Royal in January?
I think so. Because I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, so I'm to see Ed Moretti and I'm thinking maybe Portland.
Oh, but that's not
they weren't getting
that's Oakland. That's not San Francisco. That's Oakland.
But it's still Shire. It's still the
still
same.
Still Shire.
I would think he was getting his talent from the same. And I'm thinking, like, okay, Tony Rocco is a California guy. But Morocco, I don't know. This is a weird card. This is a very weird card.
He did a show on the 4th. Battle Royal run by Pampero Firpo in Santa Rosa, California. Mando Guerrero versus defeated Moondog Moretti. Woody Farmer. Oh, look at the main event. Tony Rocco defeated John Tolis.
So it's a weird mix. It seems like he's just using a local-ish crew.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know he did. I should ask Meltzer about this. And I guess looking, is there anything else on the 7th to talk about before we move on to anything else? Georgia, Mr. Wrestling 2 over Mogali and Stomper. Tony Atlas and Robert Fuller over the Free Roots. This is when Robert Fuller's booking, clearly.
Oof.
Bobby Eaton fought Ted Oates to a draw. That's kind of interesting.
That was probably good. And Kevin Sullivan and Steve Kern was probably good, too.
Yeah, 1981 especially. Florida, they both taped TV at the Sportatorium and ran Miami at the TV. Harley Race fought Dory Jr. to a draw, which, you know, with these results also, you never know what draw means because a lot of the times they just write draw if it was something, some other kind of non-finish.
And neither one of them were on the house show that night in Miami.
I wonder if that's the air date then.
Yeah.
Anything interesting here? Bugsy McGraw over Baron Von Raschke is your main event? Oof. Who's booking in 81,
Where is Dusty?
Let's see who else we got. Murdoch and Slater over Manny Fernandez and Scott McGee. That should be good.
That could be great. Yeah.
The Briscoes over Chris Markov and Nikolai Volkov. Wow, what a clash there.
Yeah, two really, really great wrestlers versus two wrestlers.
This is a weird card. Assassin 3? Jarrett ran Evansville. Tony Charles fought Billy Robinson to a draw.
That was probably awesome.
Have you seen the Dundee Charles match from 79 in Jackson?
I don't think so. I know I've seen other Tony Charles versus Billy Robinson match, I think from the Mid-South Coliseum.
No, this is Dundee, though.
Yeah, I don't think I saw the Dundee.
It is on YouTube. You have to watch that. That's really good. That's the match where Lance loved it so much that he just decided to put it on the regular TV show that week. I mean, that's the storyline, but I think it's also what he actually decided to do.
Well, Lance going all Ed Whalen and deciding what gets on the air.
What else do we have here? Tommy Gilbert and Coco Ware over Gypsy Joe and Bill Irwin. That's an interesting blend of people there. Sonny King over Danny Davis in 1981 is probably, early 81 is probably really good, actually, because Sonny King was actually really good in the stuff we have from this period. Like, I don't know. From what I've seen, like, have you seen the Ricky Morton match from TV?
I haven't.
This, like, when they changed the stock, like, I don't, have you seen much from when Robinson was in general?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a good deal of that. I remember I saw a bunch of stuff when he first came in, especially.
Because they changed the style around a bit, I always thought was interesting. And it seemed like it was because they were using him as the top babyface. That they, like, more like Matt Work, almost amateur-inspired. Like there's this really good Sonny King-Ricky Morton match. That I've, like, the best description I've seen is that's almost like a Lord Steven Regal TV title match. anything else on here? This is interesting. We've got guys doing double duty, even though it's one of the weekly towns. And not, you know, not one of the smaller ones. I mean, I know that, not that the Evansville Coliseum was big. Dundee and Tommy Rich over Jimmy Valiant and Tojo. And then Lawler and Ricky Morton over the Angel Dream Machine and Jimmy Hart. And I don't know. I mean, Charles versus Billy Robinson in a draw. That's enough for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bix, you mentioned Tojo, and I think that's a very nice segue we can make right now to revisiting something from last week. And I think everyone will get a kick out of this who enjoyed last week's show. Last week, we told a few stories from the old Nick Gulas, Roy Welch territory, one of which concerned Mario Galento, another of which concerned Dandy Jack Donovan. We're going to address the second one first. Last week on the program, I read an old Scott Teal Whatever Happened To issue, which contained an interview with Dandy Jack Donovan, which he detailed his locker room assault in, you know, allegedly, and according to him, it happened at the hands of Jerry Jarrett, Tojo Yamamoto, and Jackie Fargo. Issue shortly after that also had a letter from Len Rossi and Joe Rossi. Joe Rossi wrote it, but on behalf of him and his father, validating everything Dandy Jack Donovan said, with the exception that he wanted to specify that Len Rossi had no part in the attack. After that show went to air last week, Bix and I found something on the Wrestling Classics message board written by Jerry Jarrett about this incident. And Bix, why don't you tell us what we found?
Yeah, so this is in June 2002, right around the TNA launch. He had started posting at Wrestling Classics a bit. And I'm trying to... Oh, I almost forgot what I was going to say. Anyway, no, my point is that I did link it in last week's show description, because we found it after we recorded, but before I posted it. And should I read the whole thing? Or I guess I should, right?
Read the whole thing.
Okay. So this is June 22nd, 2002 at 9:43 p.m. Like most old... should I say what... David Williamson posted. No, it wasn't David. Oh, it was David Williamson. It was someone quoting David Williamson.
Someone quoted, and someone knowing that Jerry Jarrett was now on the message board wanted him to answer a question about this. So the person said, here's what David Williamson, a wrestling historian from East Tennessee, originally posted about this. And you can read that.
And let's see. One bad thing Tojo really did do back in 73 with the help of Fargo and Jarrett, all three popular baby faces at the time, at the TV tapes in Nashville, was dumped Dandy Jack Donovan in a private room. And I think from there, it's the versions of the story that we told last week, because he cites Whatever Happened To and all that.
Well, the thing that he cites here, too, is that this had happened because Donovan had refused to go along with Nick Gulas and Roy Welch to help screw Knoxville promoter John Kazana on a deal.
Right.
John had a good relationship with Jack Donovan, which I think is important to point out before we go to what our next segment of the program. So
yes, Jerry Jarrett. So here's what he said. Like most old war stories, this one is part true and part false. The incident had nothing to do with the Knoxville area. It was a personal issue between Jack and Tojo. During the match the night before in Louisville, Kentucky, an altercation between Jack and Tojo took place. I was not booked on the card that night and could only get reports from the wrestlers. There was conflict in the reports. Most of the wrestlers on the card did not see what happened. Tojo came to my house after the Louisville matches and explained his version of the incident. Tojo's version is that Jack jumped him from behind and stuck his finger in Tojo's eye. The ref said it happened so quick, and he thought they were still working. Which, okay, up to this point, close enough to Donovan's version of the story. Would you agree?
Yes. It doesn't go into any of Donovan's backstory about why he didn't think he it was appropriate to do the job to Tojo of the night, or that Donovan claimed that Tojo had stiffed him in the ring right before the jab to the eye, which Donovan admits freely that he stuck his finger in the Tojo's eye.
Yes. The only wrestlers to report what happened were the McGuire twins. Their version matched Tojo's, but they were in the back of the arena, not near ringside. Tojo told me that he was going to confront Jack on site unless I sent Jack packing. I explained that I would not act on the matter because I did not know what happened to cause the problem. I told Tojo to do whatever he had to do, but the office could not get involved with so little information. I was personal friends with Tojo, and anything I did would appear biased. Certainly.
Understatement.
Yeah. The next morning, we all went to the television station for pre-tape interviews. When I walked in, Len Rossi told me that there had been a problem between Jack and Tojo, and that Jack was his friend, and when Tojo arrived, he expected trouble. I think when the tense is a little weird, but so I think he's saying when Tojo when Tojo arrives to expect trouble. Would you agree? Because the tense is a little weird there. Because I don't think he's saying Tojo was already there yet.
And yes, he's saying that he expected trouble when Tojo arrived.
Yes. I advised Len to stay out of it and let Tojo and Jack settle their problem. Len said something to the effect of that Jack was his buddy and that he would get involved if a fight started. I laughed at Rossi because he was never known as a fighter, and I knew Tojo and Fargo were riding together to the TV station, and Fargo did not like Rossi to begin with. When Tojo arrived, he walked over to the McGuire twins and spoke to them. Next, Tojo walked into the dressing room and closed the door. The McGuire twins sat with their backs to the door. I was on the set making an interview with Nick Ulis. We could hear the fight, and Nick asked, "What the hell is going on?" We jumped up, went to the room, and Tojo was walking out. Jack was in pretty bad shape on the floor and was bleeding. Someone took Jack to get his head sewed up. Jack left the arena shortly after the incident. Now, for my guesses as to Jack's version, I know Jack and Tojo had a problem in Louisville. I have no idea what caused it. I would guess Jack thought he would have trouble with Fargo and I because of his problem with Tojo. Fargo, Tojo, and I were very good friends. I'll guess that Jack told Rossi that he expected the three of us to jump him at TV, and this was on his mind when Tojo walked to the dressing room. I'm guessing that after Tojo beat him, probably with the wooden shoe, Jack may have thought several people were on him. I believe that was Jack's version right after it happened. There were at least 10 wrestlers that were there when it happened, so Jack would know that everyone would know that only Tojo went into the room. And then there was another reply, but doesn't seem like it's about the incident, though.
Well, it sort of is. Before we get to that other reply, let me just say a few interesting things. In Joey Rossi's letter, he pointed out that his father was the only person who went and tried to help Dan the Jack Donovan. And, you know, obviously Jerry Jarrett is very dismissive of Len Rossi's fighting ability in this thing right here. And the idea that Tojo Yamamoto by himself went in there and beat up Dan the Jack Donovan that badly, I find preposterous. To be quite honest with you.
If he somehow blindsided him, like he knew he wasn't looking, and just clocked him with a shoe, maybe.
If he was, I mean, he had the McGuire brothers sit, for those of you who don't know, they were in the Guinness Book of World Records as the fattest twins.
Heaviest.
In history.
Yes.
Heaviest. Yeah, I mean, politically correct. They were fat and, you know, not very tall. So the other thing is, if they said they saw it from the back of the arena at the Louisville Gardens, I tend to doubt that they saw anything that went on. Two squat, fat guys did not see what happened that night. But he took the two biggest guys he found and put them in front of the door. And they sat there with the backs against the door. So no one can get out and no one can get in. And then this assault happened. Two versions of the story have Jerry Jarrett and Jackie Fargo participating in it and being involved in it. Jerry Jarrett's story has it just being Tojo, who was what, 5'5", Bix?
You're being generous.
Let's say 5'5". Let's be generous to the late Tojo Yamamoto, beating up Dandy Jack Donovan. I don't know. I hate to say it, but I don't know if Mr. Jarrett's story holds water. But anyway, Mr. Jarrett comes back. Jerry Jarrett comes back. and replies again about Len Rossi. So I guess you could read the first part. It's just one sentence there, Bix.
Yes, Nick was Len. Yes, Len was Nick's boy, and there was a lot of jealousy between Jackie and Len. It only grew after we popped Memphis and began drawing more money on Monday night than Nick and Drew all week.
So that's we now have both sides of the story, and it gets to a point where they're the same, and then it gets to a point where they break apart and are radically different. Or at least, yeah. I mean, who else could we talk to that could – one of the McGuire twins is still alive, isn't he?
I don't know.
I think one of the McGuire twins may be alive. One of them is definitely dead.
What's the real last name? I'm trying to remember.
Blythe? I'm not sure. I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Okay.
You think he's still riding around on his motorcycle?
The what's it called, though? It's not a motorcycle. It's a mini bike.
Yes, mini bike.
The publicity picture of them. The Simpsons thing? Is it the Homer becomes obese to get on disability episode where it's like where he goes to the plus size store or whatever it is?
I don't know. I'm not a big Simpsons guy.
Really?
Hey, you're not a fan of The Wire. You can't give me grief about
anything. I'm not a fan of The Wire. I just have not seen enough of it for some reason.
You watched some of it and stopped. You watched some of it and said,
when they did the marathons and stuff. Not that I started and was like, yeah, not for me.
How could you not just sit down and just get hooked on it and keep watching?
Well, I'm not crazy
you
about
that. I have no response.
Dominic West is not the most compelling actor.
Yeah, but it's not like he's in every scene.
I know.
He may not be the most compelling actor, but Omar is the most compelling character in the history of television.
Okay, their real name's McCrary and Billy is still No, they're both dead.
Oh no.
No, it was that one outlived the other by a long time.
Well, he was definitely alive in the late 90s.
Yes, he died in 2001. Benny did. And Billy died in 79.
Man.
I didn't know. I didn't realize. So that they were still wrestling then, I think, because they were New Japan in 78 or 79. Yeah. I think it's on YouTube. Have you ever actually seen the McGuire twins wrestle?
I have. It's not. They can't. I mean, it's not pretty at all.
Well, the scary thing is that they can't sit in the corner. He can't get on the apron to the corner, or because he can't stand. He just sits in the corner in the ring.
Hey, Bix, I don't know why, but talking about the McGuire brothers passing away reminded me of a quick little story you may get a kick out of. There was a wrestling fan convention in 1988.
Speaking of them dying, I have a funny story.
Yeah, it may have been the WFIA convention. I'm not sure, but there was some wrestling fan convention in 1988. And at the convention, they were reading a list of the wrestlers that had passed away that year. And they were reading it kind of slowly and trying to get, you know, have everyone, you know, pay respect and have a moment of silence. So it'd be like something, trying to think who died. Oh, it'd be like something like
Bruiser Brody.
Yeah. Well, come on, don't jump on me. Bruiser Brody. Adrian Adonis.
With applause breaks in there.
Bad. Leroy Brown. And it's something about them reading bad Leroy Brown slowly cracks me up every time I think about it.
Okay. I'm still not sure how we got there.
You got to go with it, man. That's the show.
Okay. I know that's the show. I still don't know how you got to that.
Yeah. I'm still on The Wire. Listen, so after last week's show, that covers most of the Dandy Jack Donovan. If anything else turns up or if we talk to someone who may know something, we'll definitely return to this. Much like we have LP Bay Diaz. But the other thing we talked about last week was the audio that Bo James had released of Mario Galento on Memphis Radio exposing professional wrestling. And we gave a little bit of background information on Mario Galento. And shortly after that, Bo James had hit Bix and myself up various times on Twitter, giving us more background information about that incident. So we decided to call Bo up and get him on the show this week to tell us a little bit about the Mario Galento incident, other stories about Mario Galento, as well as some of the background of the Knoxville Territory's issues with Nick Gulas, Roy Welch, and the other side of the state of Tennessee, the western side of the state. because that is one of the issues that has been brought up both by Jerry Jarrett in the statement that Vix read today and by Dandy Jack Donovan last week, that he thought it was them trying to screw John Kazana. So with that said, let's hear now what Bo James had to say about the matter.
All right. We are joined now by someone I've known on and off for years, who we've been talking with a lot the last few weeks on social media and stuff, especially after, you know, last week with the incredible Mario Galento audio that he posted on his podcast. And that is the one and only, the walking encyclopedia of East Tennessee wrestling and the reigning king of Kingsport, Bo James.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be on here. You know, it's a hard act to follow Jim Cornette, but I've had to do it a few times here the last couple of years on these podcasts.
So, Bo, last week on our program, we talked about the audio that you released on your Do You Want to Be a Wrestler Kid podcast over two episodes. It was really interesting audio from Mario Galento after several incidents had taken place, which led to him exposing professional wrestling on the air on Memphis radio. It led to one of Bix and my favorite callers of all time telling the police, stop the murder. So you contacted us after it because we tried to give an overview of what had happened, what had transpired to cause Mario Galento to do this. And we figured we should get you on the air, an expert in the subject, to tell us a little bit about what exactly happened with Mario Galento and parts of the story that we left out.
Well, people did listen, I don't know how many, you know, go back as far in history as Jim White, who was Jerry Lawler's first partner. Jim was from here in East Tennessee. He lived in East Kentucky up to his death, probably the last 10 or 15 years of his life. But I dealt with Jim quite a bit over the last, probably from, say, 94, 95 up to his past. And he ran some shows in Kentucky and used us on him, and I was around him. But he always would talk about this incident with Mario Galento because he said it was the closest that he ever came to killing somebody. And, you know, that's pretty hardcore, you know, talking about that. And he told me that was the first time I heard the story about Galento hitting the ring on TV. And, you know, they all jumped on him and, you know, beat him half to death. Jim always said they knew he was coming that day. They had been told he's coming.
The first time, and I believe
the first time.
Okay,
well,
so
when he hit the ring on Memphis TV. I think from the way Jim always implied it, that Roy was the one that talked to Galento, Roy Welch, but it actually was a setup, and it was a double cross where they talked Galento into coming to jump in the ring. That way they could legally get him and beat him up, you know, and try to hurt him. And the one thing that makes me believe that that's true, why was Jim White standing at ringside with the Billy Club? And he threw it in the lower, and then whacked the left toe in the head with it. And then they used it on him.
And I'm guessing they had not been doing like a Billy Club gimmick of any kind.
Right. It just was out of nowhere. Jim was right behind the curtain. He knew he was coming. I did a lot of the Welch family I know, and I get along with all of them just great. You know, the Fullers and the Goldens and the Fields and, you know, all that whole family. But, you know, they admit themselves in interviews and everything else. They always were plotting and planning and always had something going on somewhere in the family, sometimes even against each other. So, but I believe that Galento had ideas of running opposition, of trying to open up his own little territory there outside of Memphis, because he talked about having a wrestling school. Why else would he have a school in 1974 where there was no other schools in the country?
Yeah.
And the first school that I can ever remember hearing about was the Monster Factory. And when did that come along?
Very late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. Before that, you had to be born into the business or recruited into the business, or, you know, or just like me, had been around it all your life and
they just assumed you're part of it and let you in. You
well,
know?
Actually, wait. There were the schools in Ontario, right? Like,
yeah, but
those are, and I guess, but those weren't regular wrestling schools, though. It was still sort of like you had to buddy up to someone who would break you in type of situation, I guess.
Right. Well, you know, here in Kingsport, Ron and Don and Whitey, they got started through the boys' club. And that was the only gym and the only place that the wrestlers could work out because they had the mats and stuff. It wasn't necessarily a school. It was a place to go work out and scratch somebody. You know, if they kept coming back and you thought they had some heart or thought they had something in them that you could use, then you kind of, you know, winged them in there slowly. But Galento, he was running this wrestling school intended on having places for his boys to wrestle. So he must have, I believe that's true, that he had thoughts of running a little outlaw opposition against him, which I don't think in any way. How would his little opposition outlaw show without TV, without the Coliseum, without, you know, he would have been wrestling in VFW halls and in small schools and whatever else. You know, he was no threat to him. But I believe Roy told him, well, if you get involved in this, and then maybe we'll give you a piece of the action. But when he came, Jim White, all the way to his death, told me, we knew he was coming that day. We knew all about it. But the second time, when he came with the go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the questions that begs to be asked then from that is, as told in the Memphis Heat extra feature on the DVD, before it was Galento, it was Billy Wicks that Roy Welch had approached and tried to get to do this, offered him a great deal of money for the time. So how does that, you know, if the idea was to double cross Galento, have him, Roy Welch approaches him, tells him to go in there and beat up Jerry Jarrett and he'll collect this amount of money, but it was really to get revenge on him for starting a school. How does Billy Wicks fit into the whole equation?
That was an easy way to blackball him. Because if he would have did it, look what he did to one of the promoters, one of the bosses. You can't trust him.
So what was the heat on Billy Wicks with them at the time?
I have no idea. I've never heard that there was.
Hmm.
You know, I know he's a legit tough guy. I mean, he was the real deal.
I mean, he still has a catch wrestling school now.
Yeah, he lives not far from me, about an hour and a half from me, just over on the North Carolina side of the mountain here. He doesn't have the school now. His health he's really went down in health the last few years. Okay. But when you go into the rec center downtown in Silva, there's a monument built to him in there from where he had he trained the police officers. He trained local MMA fighters. He had a grappling school. I mean, he's well-respected and well-regarded in that community over there.
You know, Galento was considered a tough guy, too, and just very, very different than Billy Wicks. Billy Wicks was more – I hate to use the word scientific because that may not be actually fitting. But he was more of, you know, that kind of tough guy. And Galento was more of a brawler, a barroom brawler in many cases.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it would be like if you're going to make a comparison, Billy Wicks is more Luth as Mark Galento is more Harley Race.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
And Jim White always said this, too, about that. When else have you ever heard of Jerry and Jerry Lawler beating somebody up? But the one story you know about, they beat up one of the baddest dudes in the business.
Hmm.
So now you're going to double think about the double cross or going against him.
That's very interesting.
Huh. If they just beat up Galento, what are they going to do to Joe Blow off the streets? Or the guy in the opening match?
It's so Machiavellian. I love it.
These events that happened, you know, in that time, they didn't just happen, and they didn't just happen overnight. They were well thought out and planned on how to take over an area, how to get in there, how to put somebody over. I mean, it was truly business. And their livelihoods of feeding their family, paying their rent, paying their bills, relied on this. What good would have came out of Galanto hitting the ring and beating up one of the hottest baby faces you got in the territory and the hottest heel? Nothing good would have come out of Jerry Jarrett or Jerry Lawler getting beat up on TV.
Did Jim White let you know who let them in on the fact that this was happening?
Roy Welch.
Wow.
And if you listen to the audio from Galanto, he says, I came down there to accept $1,000 challenge.
Yes. He did say
so
that.
Roy told him, well, if you go do it, I'll give you $1,000.
Wow. this is really something.
They almost kill him, and he don't get $1,000.
Now, where did the Jackie Fargo, Mario Galanto thing, which I forget, the one that's in the Slam Wrestling article about Jackie Fargo, where did
that came after the second incident where he went after Lawler with the razor.
Right.
Yeah. And that happened in Mississippi, not Alabama. Mm-hmm. And Galanto was not alone.
Well, what did what do you know about that incident?
Well, they were wrestling in a spot town. You know, back then they only sent like 4 to 6 guys to a spot show. You do 3 singles, come back and tag. You know, that was their formula for years. Then it went up to 6 guys, 4 singles and a tag. But when Galanto came that time, he had 2 of Elvis's bodyguards with him that he had hired. Yeah. Okay. That he had hired. So they seen him coming as they're leaving the ring. So they keep moving. Lawler and Sam Bass keep moving. And he keeps coming. Well, when they get to the hallway, turn the corner, Jim White's waiting there. He stuck the gun right in Galanto's mouth. And standing right behind him is the police officers. Now they all get arrested. Wow. They take them to jail. And I think the town was Batesville, Mississippi. I believe is where it happened. They call Nashville and get a hold of Miss Christine and, you know, tell them what happened. They've been arrested, the whole deal. It was the week of the NWA convention. Everybody's in Vegas. She had to call out there. Oh, and then they had to get a lawyer, and the lawyer came and got them out of there. And I don't think anybody went back to court. I think that was just it, you know. And then that's when all the death threats started, and we catch you here, there, you know, whatever. But I think Galanto's whole thing was he realized, I can't get them. I'll never get to them. You know, he tried it at TV. He tried it in the town. He knew he wasn't going to get in one of the main arenas. He even told that on the audio where the police had orders to shoot him.
That's right.
Yeah. And that was after the Razor incident.
That was
so he was told he's armed. And, yeah, that was after. Because he makes mention of it in passing, but he doesn't want to tell the whole story because then he looks bad.
Do we know exactly when the audio was recorded, when the actual broadcast aired?
Mark James would be the person we need to ask about that because it was in 74 and Lou Thesz was on the card.
74.
So, yeah. I could
look that up.
Yeah, that would narrow it down of within a few days of that, you know. So, you know, and the thing about it, he went on the air and exposed the business. There's 2 things that I find funny about when he did it. He did it on Saturday morning while everybody's watching wrestling. They're not listening to him. Hmm.
I didn't know that. It's a Saturday morning broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Wow, that's interesting.
And they still had an unbelievable 13-year run after that. It did not hurt business, not one bit.
Well, even Mario Galanto could not stop the murder.
No.
That's it.
Well, and this was one of the hottest periods for that, for that, well, for that city especially, ever.
Right. Anyway. Well, this is the switch from Fargo to Lawler.
Yeah. And
right, Lawler's quest for the world title.
Yeah.
And I'm looking, and it looks like Fez was a regular in 74. So that doesn't.
Yeah, but I don't think he was there every week. It would be during the fall, or it would either be January, February, March, or towards the end of the year, because he was talking about basketball on there also. So it would have been during basketball season.
Yeah, it looks
That's right. He talked about Rick Barry. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, he's not there every week, but he's there like kind of January through June, like every other week, and then comes back in August through October. More scattered dates when he came back in the fall.
Who else is on the card there? He mentioned Fez. Who else?
I mean, there are a lot of, on that card.
Yeah, like because he talked about other great wrestlers being there.
Oh, like legitimately great wrestlers.
Right. There was no coincidence that they were booked there during this whole time of what was going on. You know, they were being used as policemen. That's why they were there.
I'm not sure because I'm trying to figure out some of these names. Like, who would be? Well, Tommy Gilmer was trained by Galento, though. I mean, I don't think he's loyal to him at this point. And this is when Tommy Gilbert's working with Luthez too. I don't know. I mean, I don't see anyone necessarily that jumps out as like known shooter, at least so far. As I'm looking through this, I mean, I'm seeing some names I don't know, like in the opener and stuff, like Alibaba or someone like that. But maybe that's one of them. But yeah,
I mean, Kirk, he'd been around for years in Tennessee.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And what was the other thing I wanted to ask about Galento? Oh, do you know if there's anything more? Like, at least, have you ever heard anything about the restaurant fight or whatever it was that Galento references getting into during that radio show?
No, really, a lot of the wrestlers at that time were in fights in restaurants, so that really wasn't anything out of the ordinary, unless you saw it, you know. Like, Fargo's in Mobile, they did a fight in the restaurant with Bob Kelly and somebody. That's how Lee Fields. That's how they started the angle. They went down to where Lee eat breakfast every morning. It made all the local papers.
That's awesome.
Well, one of the other things we talked about last week on the program, Bo, was Bix and I discussed the Dandy Jack Donovan story. We read Dandy Jack Donovan's interview with Scott Teal, as well as Len and Joe Rossi's reply the issue after, to try and clarify exactly what happened and clear the name of Len Rossi. One of the central things that Dandy Jack Donovan alleged was that at that time, there was a move being made to double-cross the Kazana brothers in Knoxville. You being the resident expert about East Tennessee wrestling, what do you know about the Kazana brothers having any problems with the Nashville booking office?
Well, Joey Kazana, if you want to go back and listen on Do You Want to Be a Wrestler Kid, when I had Joey on last year, I think I did two programs with him. He talked a lot about being a little boy at his granddad's house and sitting there listening to John Kazana cussing Nick Goulas in Greek and Goulas cussing him in Greek, you know. So there was always some kind of tension there. I've never really heard anybody ever say a bad word about John or George Kazana or Mickey Barnes, who owned the Kingsport territory. The boys seemed to love all of them guys. But the thing about up on this end, people don't realize Tennessee is a big state. There were four territories in Tennessee until 75. You had the Kingsport, which was the Tri-Cities. It ran from Greenville, Tennessee to Marion, Virginia, west-east. East Kentucky to the North Carolina line, north to south. Then the Kazanas owned Knoxville in 50 miles in every direction. Then you had Nick in Nashville. Nick handled Chattanooga, Huntsville, Birmingham, Bowling Green. And then you had the Memphis Inn, which was Memphis, Louisville, Evansville, and all the towns around there. Tupelo, Mississippi was part of that. It's the Tennessee territory, but it also connected every state that touched Tennessee, too. They had a piece of, other than Georgia. So if you take Tennessee and you turn it up from like the end of the state I'm on, East Tennessee, I can be to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania before I can be to Memphis. Huh. It's 40 miles closer. I can be in Windsor, Ontario, about the same distance to going to Memphis.
Wow.
It's 500 and some miles across. So I can go. Charlotte is about, now with the interstates being open, it's roughly a 3 to 3.5 hour trip. To where Nashville is a 4.5 hour trip. So this end of the state actually was closer to Crockett. And the Kingsport cut off in Marion, Virginia, which is exit 44 if you're going up 81 now. Crockett's territory took over at exit 70, which is Whitfield. So that's how close they were. And the TVs overlapped. In the 60s and early 70s, you could get Charlotte TV here with rabbit ears. So that means Bristol and Johnson City TV was getting over there somewhere too.
Yeah.
So they exchanged the talent. And I think the whole fear of Nashville was they were afraid that Mickey Barnes and the Kazana brothers were eventually going to go with Jim Crockett, which if they would have, Crockett would have supplied the talent and they would have lost all of East Tennessee, East Kentucky, and Southwest Virginia. There's a lot of towns. Mickey Barnes ran 5 days a week. Kazana ran two, so that's 7 towns a week, plus 2 TVs that Kazana would, or that Gulas Welch would not have had a part of. So there's many rumors on what happened here in 63 in Kingsport. Which one of them's true, I don't know. But I do know Mickey Barnes was ousted and Lester Welch took over Kingsport and the Kingsport operation. And he had it for a few years. And the reason that that happened was he had started booking talent from Charlotte. And if Mickey would have stayed running with Charlotte talent, the Kazanas would have been shortly behind doing the same, and they would have lost control. So I believe that's why they wanted Knoxville. And there's been rumors, many rumors, not just the one that you read last week, but I've heard others from Joey Kazana and other people where they had made attempts to take over John Kazana. And he held on until October of 74 when he finally sold it to Ron Fuller, who was a Welch.
What led him to sell it to Ron Fuller?
Whitey Caldwell's death.
Really?
Yeah.
Here's the people don't. They ran. They had the weekly towns up here plus the spot towns plus they had Kazana's towns. Whitey was very close to Mickey Barnes. Whitey's oldest daughter's name is Mickey. She was named after him. Whitey was very close to George and John Kazana. He made a good living working for them 2 days a week just down on that end. He made more there than he did working his day job, Ron Wright too, but they worked a job to have the benefits for their children. But when Whitey was killed, they never had the opportunity to mourn. He was killed on Saturday. Towns had to run Tuesday through Saturday the next week. They didn't have that opportunity. They couldn't take time off. Ron and Don had to keep running, but that time they owned the rights and Whitey owned Kingsport territory. They had to make sure the mail ran because Anna had to make sure Knoxville ran. And there was a big hole left, not just in being the biggest star of the territory. He was a guy that all the boys loved and respected. And now you have to go to buildings to where he used to sit, and he's not there anymore. And it was heartbreaking for him. And Kazana was an older guy. He had ran. He came to Knoxville in, I think, 33. So he'd already been there 40 years running. And he was getting older in age, and he felt it was time to get out.
And the Welches or the Fullers were always ready to buy up a territory. I mean, they owned everything from Georgia. They had a piece of Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee. What am I forgetting? I mean, they owned that entire region.
Right. Like Bo said before we started recording, I think it was basically everything in the Southeast except for the Carolinas.
Yeah. Here they had the Goldens in Paducah. That's their in-laws to the Welches.
Right.
Then Roy and Herb and Lester were involved in Dyersburg and Nashville. Then another Golden in Montgomery. Then the Fields in Mobile and across the Gulf Coast, all family. They all own little pieces of Atlanta and Georgia, and some of them own pieces of Florida. So when they came in here and bought Knoxville, they had everything except Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons they were always maybe so afraid of Crockett, because he was the closest one to that East Tennessee. He was closer to East Tennessee than, like you said, than they were in the Nashville end or the Memphis end. And
he was an East Tennessee boy, born and raised in Bristol.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. And still has family here. They still have a lot of family here. When all the trouble started with the Wrights and the Fullers and Southeastern and all that stuff, Crockett came in. Southeastern crossed the territory first. They went to Bluefield and started running Bluefield, West Virginia, which is only 120 miles from Kingsport. But it's 40 miles on or 50 miles on the other side of that territorial line. So when they went in there, Jim Jr. shows up in Bristol. Channel 5, one of the biggest stations in the country, still is to this day. WCYB. Well, guess who the program director was? Walter Crockett, Jim Crockett Sr.'s brother. So he says, "Here, Unc, you know, could you put our show on?" "Oh, yeah. I won't just put it on once a week. I'll put it on twice a week."
You know, interesting.
So now all the...
When Jim Crockett Jr. came back to promoting in 94 or 93, 94, he ran his first taping in Chattanooga,
I believe. Right. Mm-hmm. It was Chattanooga, I think. Yeah.
It was, which was always a hot town for him. He, even, you know, with the NWA, that was a hot town for Crockett Promotions. But it also was a hot town for Georgia and Goulas.
Yep. I mean, Chris Elner always used to tell me about when the Georgia office was running Chattanooga. I think it was a little, like, age-wise, I think, like, I don't think he ever went to these. I think he's a little, like, a few years too young for it. But, like, he would tell me that, like, the reputation was that, among the Georgia fans, was that it had, like, the wilder, bloodier shows. So that a lot of fans would drive in from, like, the Atlanta metro area or Macon or whatever to go to the Chattanooga shows.
Yeah. Chattanooga was the newest and hottest town all the way up until Nick's end of running, you know, and it was blood and guts and fire and fighting on the stage and crazy gimmicks and Tennessee finishes. I mean, it was something way different than Ole Anderson's, you know, Georgia wrestling, where it was holds and legitimate wrestling matches.
And Ole hated Tennessee wrestling.
Yes.
Despised it. But he worked here.
When did he work in Tennessee? In Tennessee?
He was in Knoxville in 1881. And it came through here for, you know, at different times for Ron Wright, when Ron had the Kingsport territory. One of the first places that, talking to George Sire here a few weeks ago, one of the first places that Gene and Lars Anderson wrestled as the Anderson brothers was in the Kingsport territory.
Interesting. Wow. Well,
there's so much we could talk about, but
yeah, and we're definitely going to have you on again, Bo. Just not only to talk about East Tennessee wrestling history, but I know Bix and I have expressed an interest on previous episodes and something you share a desire to with us. But that was a horrible sentence.
Yes.
But the search for what exists on videotape still, the search for what wrestling could still possibly be out there. We're gonna probably do an episode pretty soon just discussing that, and we definitely want you on there as well. But before we wrap up with you, and before I want you to plug everything you have out there, you mentioned to Bix and myself that you had a story about Ron Wright fighting with the Klan, and we'd love to hear that.
Which sounds amazing.
It sounds amazing.
Well, everybody knows the story of, well, people that know about Ron Wright, which one of my things is to make sure that his legend lives on forever. Not just him, but guys like Ed Wolf. Have y'all ever heard of Ed Wolf?
I've heard the name maybe from stuff like you've written, but I'm not familiar with him, really.
Ed Wolf looked like Road Warrior Hawk in 1968.
Wow.
He was a cop with an unbelievable body, big guy, great athlete, great guy. That Ron had trained, Ron and Don had trained, and him, Ed Wolf and Frank Morrell started together in the Kingsport Territory. And Ed ended up in 75, I believe, or 74. I'd have to look. Him and Ron wrestling the Hells Angels in Johnson City, the Dupree brothers, Chris Colton, the other Dupree, they threw Ed out of the ring. Somebody had left a wooden folding chair at ringside. When he hit it, it shattered, and the leg of the chair went all the way through his thigh. Mm. And he ended up losing his leg because, medicine was not then what it is now, and they tried to save it, but he got gangrene and ended up losing his leg. But he would have been – him and Whitey Caldwell were going to be the big team. That was a smaller, fast guy, veteran with Whitey, and this big, young, strong man. And it just didn't work out. Whitey got killed, a couple of years before that. And Ed was still getting a good push. He's a top baby face here. And the injury came. But there's so many guys that worked here, like Ron and Don and Whitey. And I want to keep their memory alive. I want people to know about them, because he got little to none magazine coverage. Bless Jim Cornette for the stuff that he did with Smoky Mountain, shining the spotlight on him for new generations. And I got a book coming out all about him. But the people know the story that know about Ron Wright, about his plane getting set on fire in Harlan, Kentucky. His plane was not set on fire. It had dynamite thrown up underneath it, and it blew up. It was on fire when Ron pulled in there with Phil Hickerson and Dennis Condrey. And Ron was not even, he was managing. He wasn't even wrestling then. But they figured out he'd been in there so many years. Do you guys know who Tony Peters is?
Not sure.
Yeah, I don't know if I
do. Okay, Tony's another guy from here at Kingsport. He worked all over the place. He worked for the Nick Goulas, for the Poffos. There's some tapes on the ICW stuff that's floating around that Tony's on there. Him and Bob Orton Jr. and him and Boris Malenko both were tag champions for the Poffos. But when he got out of the Marines to come home from Vietnam, he met Ron Wright. Tony grew up a big wrestling fan. And he told this story at Ron's funeral. He said the first time that he'd ever really talked to Ron, he told Ron he wanted to get into the wrestling business. And Ron said, well, what are you doing today, boy? And he said, nothing. He said, well, you're going to drive me to Harlan, Kentucky. So they take off to Harlan, which is a two-lane road. Most of it is still, most of it's a two-lane road from here. So about 20 miles outside of Harlan, he looks at Tony and says, you know how to fight? He said, well, I just got home from Vietnam. He said, I mean with your fist and your feet. Yeah, he said, well, good, because we're going to have to fight our way in here and out of here. So they pull up to the armory. They literally, he said, watch Ron Wright fight his way to the dressing room. Then when he went to the ring, he had to fight. And then when the match was over, they had to fight to the car to get out of there. That's how bad Harlan, Kentucky was. Man. And people think that's old times. I've wrestled in Harlan a few times in the 90s and in 2000s. I have never wrestled in Harlan where a fight has not broke out in the crowd. They call it Bloody Harlan for a reason. There's blood on the streets every Saturday night. So that's where they blew the plane up. Well, shortly before they blew the plane up, Ron was managing Norvell Austin and Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dogs.
What? Wait, really?
Yeah.
I did not know about that.
Yeah. So, at the same time, the Stomper has just came into the territory. He'd been there a little bit longer. Stomper came in 76. They got there 77 or 78. Whenever it was the first territory that Sylvester Ritter worked. So, when they stop in Harlan to get out, the Klan is waiting on them. How dare Ron Wright bring two black wrestlers to Harlan and a foreigner? And they're out front of the armory waiting on them. They had to fight the Ku Klux Klan to get into the ring or into the building. Then they had to fight them to get into the ring. Then they had to fight them when it was over with. Well, the police didn't help because most of the police were Klan members themselves. people go, well, those days are past. I invite you to take a ride with me anytime you want to go through East Kentucky or Southern West Virginia. I'll show you some places.
I've been to Barberville. That was an experience.
Barbersville compared to Harlan and Hazard and Pikeville is like, let me figure out how to do this. What's the worst place in Jersey?
All of it. No, I really don't know. Maybe Newark?
Yeah, Newark. I've been to Newark. I agree with that. That would be Harlan and Hazard. And then what's the garden spot of, say, the Northeast? Connecticut?
Yeah.
That'd be Barbersville. They're civilized in Barbersville.
It's the Connecticut of Kentucky?
Yeah. If Southeast Kentucky, oh, yes. They're civilized there. You know, they at least have a radio station, you know, colored TV, and a college.
Well, listen, Bo, this was great. We definitely want to have you on again real soon. Why don't you tell all of our listeners out there how they could get in touch with you and some of the things you're involved with?
You can follow me on Kingsport on Facebook, facebook.com/pro wrestler Bo James, BEAU. Everybody spells my name wrong. Or my website, kingofkingsport.com. I've got my books on there, DVDs, some real rare stuff of, East Tennessee wrestling you can find on there. And, I'm on Twitter also at King of Kingsport, which is one of the greatest things I ever got from Ron Wright was him telling me to call myself that and go on TV and challenge him to fights, which I did when we first got TV. And it was great because I was a cocky young heel, and how dare him challenge Brother Ron to a fight when Ron's sick and not able to even stand, you know.
And YouTube, also King of Kingsport on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, YouTube.com/King of Kingsport. And I've been putting a lot of stuff up on my YouTube because my promotion, Southern States Wrestling, is celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. And I've been sharing all kinds of stuff. I've put up an episode of classic stuff with the Batten Twins the other night. I got some more stuff coming with Tracy Smothers, Ricky Morton, Bobby Fulton, the Mongolian Stomper, just all kinds of people that have worked for me over the years. And I've been so blessed that, you know, I started a wrestling promotion at 16 years old, and I'll be 42 in July, and it's still running.
And a really underrated promotion. I mean, you had some, like, I was telling you, I love that match that you and your cousin Casey Thunder had with the Battens, that great Loser Leaves Town cage match, which part of it is up on one of the things you posted recently, and just a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, I'm working on too some DVDs. I've got one that I've been working on the last few weeks. It's called Family Feuds, which will include the whole match. But also, that was only the first runaround with the Batten Twins. We were the favorites. They were the heels. And then we switched heel after we ran them out of town. We worked a program with Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden. The last run that Fuller and Golden had as a team was for me here in East Tennessee. Oh, and after that, the Batten Twins return is the fan favorites. And we had a whole other run with them then. So, you know, it was, we're a traditional wrestling promotion, which there's not many of them left. And for many years, it was the only reason that I got out of bed in the morning was to, you know, promote wrestling and do stuff. But I've got a whole lot of other stuff going on now in my life and speaking places and writing books. And I've got, the first book on the Kingsport territory will be out in days. I mean, literally days. But I have four more because this territory ran for decades. And I foolishly thought when I started putting it together, I could put it all in one book, and you can't. So I broke it down. The first one started coming out is the 60s. That way people can learn about Ron and Donna and Whitey. And they, Ron and Don both helped me so much. Whitey's widow helped me. Cora Combs, all these people that's passed in the last few years, Jim White helped me with the history and explained the territory and how it was ran. And I lay it out for you. I mean, you can just start with the newspaper clippings and go week by week and read my notes in there on how they booked it. You know, how the legend of Ron and Whitey started. And, you know, it started by accident because Pat O'Connor and somebody else no-showed the town. And they had to put Ron and Whitey in the ring. And it was their first big match to show off in front of everybody. And Whitey split Ron with the hard way. And Ron threw Whitey out of the ring so hard he broke his shoulder and was out of business for a year. So,
well, we definitely got to check out all that. We're really looking forward to the first of your four book set of the history of East Tennessee. And
yeah, like I'm gonna get on that as soon as you put it out.
Yeah, me too. But once again, Bo, thanks for doing this.
Thank you guys for having me. Anytime, just give me a yell.
You know, Bix, I consider myself a little bit of a classic wrestling snob. I feel like I know more than most people. I feel like most people don't know what they're talking about. But everything Bo James said to us, both during the period of time that we recorded for this broadcast and before it on the call when we weren't recording, I feel like almost everything he said was something I didn't know that he educated me on with the East Tennessee territory. And more than ever before, I just want to know more.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I can't wait for that book he's going to come out, which he said is any day now.
Yeah, any day now. And I think he said it's the first of several books he's working on about the history of the East Tennessee territory. I'm assuming it's going to be sort of the way Jim Cornette's book went up to, what, 1975, 1976? I forget exactly.
That's what right, something like that. And this one's going to be starting with the 60s, with the peak of Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell and all that.
Yeah, and he mentioned, you know, that was a period of time where John Kazana's promotion was, you know, in a state where it may be under attack, and the threat of Jim Crockett, the hometown boy, coming back in to the rescue scared Welch and Gulas so much. And I guess all the Welch family, because they were all around that area surrounding it.
Yeah, it is fascinating what would have happened, like to think about what could have happened if Crockett came in. I mean, I guess it wouldn't have changed history that much because I guess just the way that East Tennessee fit into everything else, that it was never like a huge territory and it didn't play into like Memphis, which I guess you think of as having more ties to like other promotions. But it would have been really interesting.
Yeah, you know, I while he was talking, one of the things that popped into my head was he was describing the East Tennessee territory. And, you know, it's Knoxville was kind of John Kazana's town. And then there was the East, you know, Kingsport and everything else that went with that. And he was saying it went up to Marion, Virginia. And it just got me thinking that was the Smoky Mountain territory, because I went to a show at Smoky Mountain Wrestling in Marion, Virginia.
Right.
And I mean, there were a few additional towns, obviously. There was like, you know, Beckley, West Virginia, which I think, you know, ICW ran, and then Georgia Championship Wrestling ran. And then later on, you know, Jim Crockett's NWA ran. But, you know, other than that, for the most part, East Tennessee and East Kentucky to places like Marion, Virginia, that was what became Jim Cornette's territory, was what had been those two territories, the Kingsport territory and the Knoxville territory.
All right. Yeah, the little outliers like the Cincinnati suburb in Kentucky that Smoky Mountain would run and places like that, just these like occasional other like spot towns. And that was more because Les Thatcher was involved, I would
think. Right. Right. Erlanger, I think, right?
Yeah, Erlanger, it? Kentucky. Yeah.
That's where Dan Severn won the NWA title from Chris Candido.
Yep. And yeah, I guess it is. And then, you know, and of course, as we talked about last week, that Cornette's original plan for Smoky Mountain was to include some of the Crockett cities that weren't necessarily, I don't know, being tended to as well by WCW, like, you know, what were you saying, Roanoke, Charleston,
Greenville,
West Virginia, Greenville.
All the way down to Chattanooga, which wasn't really a Crockett town, but was actually an old Nick Gulas town.
That became a Georgia town and all that, right?
Right. Yeah. So really great job with Bo James. We definitely need to have him on the show again. And you know, probably when the book comes out and me and you have a chance to really go through it and review it, we'll have him on to talk a little bit more about it once you and I are even more familiar with the history of the East Tennessee wrestling territories. I was about to say territory, but I guess we have to say it's territories now that we found out Tennessee had four territories, not three, as is the popular myth. But going from that, going from the great talk we had with Bo James to our next segment, and boy, what a different show it is this week. We had, you have the usual Brian and Bix talk, and then we have now segments on the show. We're getting more professional by the week, Bix. We have this week's Dennis of the Week, and for the first time, we have a guest on the show to talk about the Dennis Carluzzo stories. The Dennis Carluzzo stories. Boy, I screwed that up. Dennis Carluzzo stories.
Well, he is the Dennis Carluzzo.
There's only one of the true characters in the
history. Technically there are two, but...
Well, yeah, technically there are two. That's right. His eldest son, Dennis, who, if by any chance, he never liked wrestling. If he's listening, Dennis, hello. But anyway, this week's Dennis Carluzzo story of the week is going to be a little different because it's not just going to be about Dennis, but we're going to have a little bit of other information, some really funny stories here. And the person we spoke to was Tom Robinson, who, as you're about to find out in the next segment, was someone who was involved with Dennis's shows for many years. And famously, Dennis ran a benefit show for him when he got sick with what we will term a mystery disease. In 1990, the famed Tom Robinson benefit, which was an independent super show for 1990, you know, we'll talk more about it in the weeks to come, just how different independent wrestling was in the late 80s, early 90s to what it is now. But the Tom Robinson benefit was one of the really major shows. As Tom will say here in this interview, people like Dave Meltzer flew in for it, and people from all over really came for this show. But without further ado, this week's Dennis of the Week, an extended Dennis of the Week, is Bix and my talk with Tom Robinson. Enjoy. So we're here for the Dennis of the Week this week with Tom Robinson. Tom's a name that many people would probably remember from being around Dennis's shows and around the Northeast wrestling scene for a good number of years. Tom, give us a little bit of your background.
Just a longtime fan. I discovered where the wrestlers stayed and stalked them, which is pretty much my activity now for the Divas at age 46. But, yeah, I found out that they stayed at the old Best Western in Philly. So I got a ton of pictures with, you know, the old school guys, Andre and the Samoans and whatnot. And I'm bad on years. Then the NWA came through. I knew who Dennis was through wrestling radio, Dennis Carluzzo, who we're going to talk about in detail. I always wanted to. My dream was to manage in Memphis against Jerry Lawler, and that was it. That was all I wanted to do. And I got offered that opportunity at one point, but there was no pay, and I had a family and was making 60 grand a year, so I turned it down. So that's about it. Just a fan, basically. I was on about 100 shows, wrestling or managing mostly.
And how did you first meet Dennis?
It was an outdoor show. I knew who he was, and he knew my name from the Observer readers page. And, you know, you couldn't miss the guy. He was so animated. I think he was wearing a Hawaiian shirt at that time. And I introduced myself. He knew my name and took me under his wing, so to speak. He's like, "Hey, man, well, what do you want to do, man? Do you want to wrestle? You want to?" I weighed like 135 pounds. That was the era of everybody weighing 400 and 280, juiced up, et cetera. So I said, "Well, I kind of eased my way in, whatever I could do, man. I'd appreciate it." And the next show, I was ring announcer for him and Larry.
Wow. And I think one of the things people most recognize with your name and Dennis is the Tom Robinson benefit show in, I want to say, November of 1990.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, that was... That was a really cool deal. Through Dennis, I owe everything to Dennis and Cornette, basically, for those relationships. I started driving the guys when Crockett had that two planes. Dusty and Crockett had two private planes, and they would come into the Civic Center, and I remember Dennis saying, "Bring your car," and the first guys I drove were Paul Jones, Ivan Koloff, and the great T. Joe Kahn. But it was like they you know, they just wanted a free ride to the show, and the very famous Dennis line, "Don't worry about it, man, he's cool." I mean, that was all they needed to jump in the car. And I'm like 16 or 17 years old, maybe 18, I don't know. And you know, I tried to talk Carney with them and stuff, but they just didn't want to hear it. They just wanted to get to the show. You know, I'm like, "You guys are great workers." You know.
Did T.J. Kahn say thank you?
Yeah, T.J. Kahn should still be thanking me for that one. But I was just kind of a stooge, basically. And one thing led to another, and all of a sudden I'm managing Sabu and Candido in Minnesota. Oh, back to the benefit. I skipped over that. I ended up collapsing at work, like, randomly. I was having strange symptoms, and then just lost a ton of weight. I was down to 109 pounds. Currently speaking to you at 295. But I was always skinny growing up. So I lost about 50 pounds at the time. And one test after another was inconclusive. They diagnosed me with systemic lupus, but I know what it turned out to be later. I'd rather keep that private unless I get drunk, but it was a legitimate illness, and maybe you could read through the lines. And it took me out, and I was undiagnosed for quite some time. Think Al Capone.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Yeah, that's kind of that DSL. The guys that I made friendships with were the Midnights. I was always driving Bobby and Stan back if they didn't want to go to dinner. Basically, if Bobby wanted beer and Stan wanted pussy, I'd drive them back. And Dennis and Frank Chili and Cornette would go to the old Rivet. And my friend Joe Lilly and Jamie Ward, they were around. And we had some nice times. And so they came up. Cornette came to my house with Dennis to visit me. Out of the blue, Foley came over to the house. It was a bad time, but a good time at the same time, if that makes sense. And a lot of guys, Meltzer flew across the country, came, seen the show. We drew about 1,200 people. Dennis was supposed to pay my medical bills. And I think some of them are still outstanding, but yeah. I got well, and then, as Cornette said, the next time I saw him, I felt better and got back into weightlifting and stuff, and then my metabolism changed. And Cornette's like, "Jesus fucking Christ, last time I seen you, you're dying, and now you look like fucking Vader."
You know, for any of our listeners who haven't seen that, I'm sure it's on YouTube. The main event of the Tom Robinson benefit in 1990 was the Midnight Express with Jim Cornette against Terry Funk and Cactus Jack, except Bobby Eaton suffered an injury right before the match. So Eddie Gilbert replaced him. And Eddie Gilbert and Stan Lane against Terry Funk and Cactus Jack, managed by Mark Curtis, Brian Hildebrand, is really just such a perfect indie match for that time. That's like as big an indie match as you can get in 1990. Independent wrestling is so different now than it was then, but that's like a dream match for the independent scene.
Yeah, that was pretty badass. And a little unknown trivia note, useless trivia. A young Sandman worked that show for free to try to help me out. And then I ended up boxing him for Damon Feldman, where he double-crossed me and almost knocked me cold.
Oh, I forgot that was you.
Yeah, that was me. He fucked me over good in the second round. It was me. I've been around long enough to not trust wrestlers, but I trusted him for some reason. And then we decided to work the match, and I gave him the first round, and I got popped in the nose, and I looked at him. I was talking through the mouthpiece, and there was a legit ref that wasn't in on it. I'm going, "What the fuck are you doing?" And the ref's like confused, and he's like, "He's hitting you, man. He's hitting you." We're in a boxing match, of course, but the second round was supposed to be mine, and I'm hulking up. I had 450 people bought tickets to see me fight the Sandman, and he bounces off the rope and, like, hits me with a left, you know, I had my hands down because I, you know, I thought it was a work up until that point. And I was on Dream Street. Could not be out there, the big pussy. I'll see him in an Acme or something someday.
Hey, I got to ask you, I remember Dennis telling me a story. I don't know if you know it as well. If you do, please tell it. About, I believe it was the weekend of the Tom Robinson benefit show, where Dr. Mike Lano came and stayed at his house.
I you could probably explain it better than me, because I remember bits and pieces. My memory's bad, but Lano's a great guy. He gave free dental to the boys and stuff, but a little off his rocker at times. I assume that's where you're going.
I believe the story I remember, and you know, my memory's pretty good, but I may be a little wrong on some of the facts, was he stayed at Dennis's house, kept them up all night by cleaning the house, vacuuming and stuff, and then cleaned out the refrigerator. He ate all their grapefruits and various other things and left them with an empty refrigerator.
Exactly. Now I remember. Yeah, he's like, fucking Lano, man. I'm sleeping, and I hear this fucking noise, and he always used to, his wife, God, I guess his wife is named Debbie, right?
Yeah, I think so.
He's like, I'm chilling with Debbie, and she's like, who you got down there? I went down, it's fucking Lano cleaning the house. Fucking retard, you know. And the one thing I always used to remember, Dennis had those signature one-liners. He'd be like, after we'd meet for an iced tea at the random diner, he'd be like, well, I was called Pissy. That's a story in itself. That's how Cornette knows me, Bobby Eaton. If you walked up to him and said, Pissy said hi, he would know that was me. But if he said Tom Robinson, he might be like, wait, I know that name. But anyway, I kind of went out of order. But he would call me Pissy, and he'd throw these one-liners at me like, hey, Pissy, I think I'm going to get some strange pussy tonight and fuck my wife.
I got to say, your Dennis impression is stellar.
Well, it used to be on, but I, you know, God rest his soul, it's been over a decade. And, I was looking at some YouTube today just to kind of remember the cadence and so forth. But, yeah, I used to do it. I used to be able to call people and have them think it was him. I jotted down some notes, which are fucking funny. If I can jump all around, maybe you can put this together and make sense later.
Just because things are
jumping in my head. My first girlfriend was Angel Amoroso, who was an ECW as Angel.
That's right.
And Angel. Yeah, she, like I was 17, and turns out she was younger than me, but she told me she was older, and she had like triple F breasts, so what was I to think, you know? So I was with her, and needless to say, she kind of got into digging wrestlers a little better than digging wrestler stooges. And she would kind of disappear sometimes if I was like at a show and running an errand. Dennis would say, go pick up Terry Funk at the airport or something. So I'd come back and I'd be looking for my girlfriend. I'd be like, hey, Dennis, you seen Angel around? He's like, last time I seen her, she was under the bleachers blowing Ox Baker. Of course, Ox Baker was nowhere, you know, on the show, but just out of his, you know, just out of the blue coming up with that was, he could cut you up and not offend you. And I'll give you another case in point. Frank Chile, who Jim Cornette mentioned on your show, Frank's gay. Frank is like out and proud and all that shit now, so he wouldn't be offended if I talked about him. But back then it was a little different, so only a few of us knew. But we'd go to a random spot to get something to eat, and the waitress would say, can I help you? What do you guys want? And Dennis would be like, give Frank a cock omelet. And Frank would crack up. Frank dug it, you know. Never offended him.
You know, you brought up Angel Amoroso before, and you brought up the fact that she was younger than you thought. And that makes me remember a story that I had heard when Tully Blanchard was in ECW for, you know, a cup of coffee in, I want to say, early 94, maybe early 95.
95.
95. So again, Tully's in there in early 95. He had left the WWF in 89, left NWA in 88. They're at the hotel after the show, and there's a birthday cake. And Tully says, what's going on? And Angel says, it's my birthday. I just turned 21. And Tully, you know, who's now religious, takes a step back, and he starts adding up in his mind. If she just turned 21 now in 95, you know, when I used to see her in 88 or 89, and
Fifth City. Okay, that was Brian Knob didn't know that he was friends with everybody in the NWA era. So he's kind of cocky to him, and he's like, hey, Pissy, man, I was so close to going Fifth City with them fucking nasty boys and fat slobs. And he legit believed – I always remembered Fifth City. I never heard that described in a fight, but he was so confident he could beat up Knobs and Saggers at the same time. Eddie Gilbert and Missy Hyatt used to go to the Ribbit with us, and the first night Missy was kind of leg on Eddie and rubbing Eddie and things of that nature, just affectionate. They were in love. She wasn't doing anything that graphic, but you know, I was noticing, he was noticing. We were kind of looking at each other, and he called me that night after on a landline. That's all we had back then. He's like, I guess he was home and he didn't want his family to hear. He's like, hey, man, did you see Missy? I was like, yeah, dude. He's like, Jesus Christ, when she was rubbing his leg, my dick was hard as Chinese arithmetic. I had some great times with him, man. He, Memphis trip. The only trip I had with him alone was Volunteer Slam for Smoky Mountain. It was, he and I. Do you have time for this one real quick?
Of course we did.
It was usually Frank or Jamie Ward or Joe Lilly or, you know, it was a bunch of us usually. And this was probably, I used to go to his house alone, but this was probably the only road trip I went alone with him. And it was Cornette's first, you guys would probably know the date. It was Cornette, it's Volunteer Slam for Smoky Mountain. I think it was his first big show for them.
92 yeah. Was the first one.
Yeah, so let me try to explain this, boy, so you'll understand these references. In Memphis, we went to a Memphis trip with Wrestling Radio, and Kenny Bolin and Dennis were kind of heel characters down there already. And myself and my buddy Joe Lilly were hanging with them, and we had Memphis's kayfabe. Everybody believed in it in the 80s. And we had a reason to hang with the heels, and he was telling everybody, I think it was in a movie, Blazing Saddles. It was one of the Mel Brooks movies, that there was a piss boy that just, you know, did whatever that the guy said. So he just said, oh, they're my piss boys. Don't fuck with them. And sure enough, we ended up with matching outfits, and we were in the Mid-South Coliseum in the ring with our piss boy outfits on. So Cornette and all those guys forever call me Pissy. I don't have a urinary problem or anything, but anyway, he to explain the Volunteer Slam and why I always say Pissy, because that's how he addressed me. He was like, hey, man, let's go down here. Cornette's hooking us up, man. He's got his new gig going. And I was like, fucking A, you know? And he always had a scam. He had this brother, Arnold, the biological brother, Arnold. I think he had one other brother as well. But Arnold looked just like Dennis with hair. And he worked in the Philadelphia airport. He's since passed away as well. But I guess Arnold had the same kind of scam mentality that Dennis had. And we flew we must have had six layovers. We got the tickets for $25 each. But he's like, yeah, my brother Arnie will hook us up, man. He's a big wig at US Air. We stopped everywhere. We had like a 4-hour layover in St. Louis. And I just happened to have Harry White's number. Do you guys know Harry White?
Oh, Harry's a friend of mine, sure.
Yeah, I called Harry from the airport payphone. He just happened to be home on, you know, whatever day it was. Picked us up, and we went to Ozzy Smith's restaurant. So, strange, it worked out great. But we get down there, or actually, I'm skipping again. I'm getting old, guys. I'm 46 now. We jump on the plane with these bullshit-ass tickets, and as soon as we walk on, he sits down, and he grabs me as I'm continuing to walk to my seat. You sit the fuck down, asshole. And I'm like, okay. He sits in first class, and he goes, hey, hon. And I'm underage. I'm clearly underage. I got pimples growing like fresh fruit, for Christ's sake. You know, it was like so obvious I'm not 21. He's like, can you get him a Jack and Coke and almond iced tea? And she's like, sure. All of a sudden, we got drinks and food in front of us. We flew first class. I think it was 3 out of 4 flights to get there that we flew first class, but we got busted on the third one, I think it was. But it was so funny because I had such anxiety. I didn't like to fly as it was. And he was like, just sit down, drink that shit. You'll feel better. And after he would get over, he'd be like a school kid. He had such school kid energy and such a funny smile. And then he'd have that signature high five. So every time the flight attendant would give me another drink, he'd wait till she was like in the clear and then give me that signature high five. And he'd be like, fucking A, pissy, first class. We're fucking Ric Flair, man. Yeah, he was fucking great. He was his best. So we get the volunteer slam and first class seats. Took us like 80 hours to get there. And Cornette welcomed us. We were in the back. If you see any tapes out there, if you've seen any, with Brian Lee bleeding, doing promos, or Paul Orndorff for the Heavenly Bodies, that was me taping from the locker room because I was such a mark that I was told not to tape, and I snuck that big old camera back there and was taping them anyway. Then I swore to Cornette I wouldn't send it out, and send it out to one person, two person. Next thing I know, it's all over the place. But he knew I was a mark, Cornette, so he didn't give a fuck, and he's been there too. But the one thing from the trip was, like, Dennis had been just a gab that could take anybody. Orndorff just came off, you know, it was a few years earlier, I guess. You know, that big run with Hogan where he drew, what, 60,000 in some stadium for house show?
6 years earlier was his big run with Hogan, which was Hogan's most successful house show run with any opponent.
Yeah, and I turn around, you know, and Dennis is holding court with, like, all these Smoky Mountain, you know, the Rock and Roll Express or whoever was there at the time, and Paul, he was like, hey, Paul, you know what's wrong with Vince, man? And I don't know what he said. I didn't hear it, but it was something that Paul Orndorff totally agreed with. Orndorff stopped what he was doing, pulled up a chair, and just sat there and listened to Dennis for like an hour before he had to go out to his match. It was amazing. And, you know, some of the stuff was, you know, exaggerated, guessed, whatever, but he had the whole locker room, like, the Cornette had to yell at people to get their attention, you know, just to go over matches and shit. Hey, Dennis could light up a room. You know that, Bri, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, Dennis was later on Smoky Mountain TV, I believe, as the representative of Chris Candido. Was it that he was – first he was the head of the WWA, which was Chris Candido was the heavyweight champion of. But then was he a part of the conspiracy to say that Tracy Smothers was actually Vito Marinara? He wasn't from the South?
Yes, Vito Marinara from – I forget how you pronounce it because it's spelled like Schuylkill Haven, Pennsylvania, but it's like Schuylkill Haven, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that sounds about like it. He had the original ideas like that. I sent you guys a tweet today. I don't know if that was the full one, but – where he had Fred the Elephant Boy and his brother as Jerry Lawler's illegitimate son in New Jersey.
Well, you know, there's a few of those around. And the one thing that I always think about, one of the things I always think about when it comes to Dennis's shows that I never hear anyone bring up, Fred the Elephant Boy is obviously acclaimed in the sense that he was on Howard Stern. So everyone knows him as this weird character who smells really bad and can't speak. Yeah. And he was never on Stern, and I've never heard it brought up, but Fred's brother was equally as bizarre as Fred. What a specimen this guy was. And I mean, there were shows that Dennis had where, for no reason, I couldn't figure out why, Fred's brother, whose name slips me, was walking around dressed like a cowboy with a cowboy hat and two little toy guns in his side, and He was like full blown cowboy just walking around at the wrestling show.
Yeah, he had his own gimmick. He called himself. He talked like Fred, and he was like, "Hello, my name is Kid Vicious." He went by right, Kid Vicious. And somehow, I think I was managing Lawler, and Dennis put him in there with whoever the B-face was or something. I just remember being a manager and Kid Vicious being, I was supposed to just get rid of him after he said something. It might have been a continuance on the illegitimate son or something. And Lawler said, just beat him up and throw him out of the ring. And I'm assuming that he has some kind of training if they threw him in the ring. And I just grabbed him by with the pant, the belt buckle, and the collar, and threw him out with a little force. And the fucking guy, he did like a goddamn ricochet fucking senton into the audience, you know, unintentionally. I was like, fuck, man, I think I just killed Kid Vicious. You know, like, that's gonna suck killing Fred the Elephant's boy's brother for 25 rolled up $1 bills. You know, that was always my payoff from Dennis, but I didn't give a shit, man. He, like, I really paid to have fun, and I was in all these ridiculous things that I had no business being in. I got double noggin knockered by Benoit into Lawler's head. Snook ahead, but like any childhood fucking dream I had, Dennis pretty much made. Dennis was my make-a-wish, put it that way. You know, say again.
It's funny you talk about your childhood dreams, and the first two people you name are the two murderers on the list.
Isn't that weird? If Johnny K-9 had headbutted me, we'd have a triple threat there. That's fucked up. Yes. Two guys that murdered people beat me up.
Has Snuka had the Metal Maniac defense yet, where he says it wasn't him, it was the Metal Maniac?
That's exactly who I managed against him. It was the Metal Maniac in their 5,000th match, I guess. That was how he got booked.
What exactly is the relationship there? Like, was he just his stooge, Metal Maniac? Or?
I would think so. What do you think, Bri?
Yeah, it was just weird, because eventually they broke up, too, and then you never saw the Metal Maniac anywhere again. I remember one time, someone who I used to know from the New York hotline scene was a friend with Ben Lagerstrom, who could irritate and anger some people, and then they probably didn't realize how humorous he found it. He did something to piss off the Metal Maniac, and the Metal Maniac left him this voicemail, which was like the promo he never got to cut on any program ever. And it was just amazing. And I remember he got to the point where he was like trying to end it, but he didn't end. He kept going and going. And he had this classic quote, which we often repeated from time to time, which was, "You got to make a decision, brother. Ass broken or ass in jail? What will you do?"
This has nothing to do with Metal Maniac, but one of the funny things that I goofed on, not that I can handle my beer too well these days, but I didn't handle it that well in 89 or so. Whenever the second UAWF fan convention was, it was in Chicago, and there was a place called Stay Out All Night, and Dennis wasn't there, but I'm drinking with Buddy Rose and Ed Wiskowski, Colonel of Beers. So, I took a little of Kenny Bolin and Dennis with me everywhere as far as my maybe stretching the truth a little bit, but I was, you know, buzzed up and didn't realize what I had said. So I had just put over Dennis and put over the WWA and affiliated with Larry Sharp and whatnot. And Dennis had a side business. He was an insurance salesman for Prudential.
That's right.
And I gave a call one afternoon. He's like, "What in the fuck you do, pissy?" And I go, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "My secretary comes out and says the military's on the phone." I said, "What?" And she goes, some kind of colonel. I'm like, that motherfucker. Apparently, I told Colonel De Beers I was the booker and called Dennis for booking. And he called Dennis at the office. That, you know, Dennis is like, he was pissed at me, but he couldn't stay super hot at me because it's a funny story. You know, he gets a call from fucking Colonel De Beers, and that's how he introduced himself to Dennis's real life, real job secretary.
So I guess military. That's great.
I guess I over exaggerated my value with.
This has been great, Tom. In closing, is there any last thoughts or memories you have of Dennis you want to share as we leave the segment?
Besides him feeling up every girlfriend I ever had, he was a very special part of my life. I'm nothing more than a observer, reading fan who's had some opportunities. I was on a lot of shows, but if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be. I had no business. When I trained as a wrestler, I sucked. I'm just shooting from the hip, as they say, as Paul Heyman would say. But Dennis always found a spot for me, introduced me to Chris Candido to where I wanted to point this out before I got off. Dennis, and it echoes what you're saying about how he took young people. The only problem Dennis had is he was too nice. He would tell 5,000 people to show up on the 23rd and he'll use them.
Yeah.
And then he didn't know where to put everybody. So sometimes, you know, I would be going out with Queen Destiny. I don't know if you remember her.
Jackie.
Yeah. Just seconding somebody. But luckily through Dennis, I met Chris Candido, who always had something for me to do. Like when they came, WWF was using he and Sonny. And Dennis is like, hey, Pissy, I'm going to have to take care of you in the next show, man. I booked too many fucking people. And Candido just pulled me over and goes, dude, you just come out with us. You'll be a body Donna in training. Just, you know, you look like shit. Candido was ripping me, but it was true. And so they trained me, made fun of me, and then I took some bumps for Ace Darlin, but basically 99% of what I did was Dennis. Maybe 98, Dave Meltzer, 1%, and 1% me. You know, Dave Meltzer, Dennis Carluzzo, Cornette too. A lot of, you know, but Dennis is like the key factor in all that. So I wish he was still around. I'll give you my last thing on Dennis, what he did by invitation only, so to speak. Funk and Murdoch worked for him, and it was just him and them two at the Hilton, the old Marriott, and he knew I was a Funk pseudo-friend and a Murdoch mark, and I got to drink Coors Light with Dick Murdoch and Terry Funk while Dennis drank iced tea, and that's like, for a wrestling kid, you know, that's a dream come true. I don't even know if I was 21, you know, and hearing all those stories from Amarillo to Japan to wherever else, it was just like incredible. So I get a little choked up. I mean, this is kind of weird because we were just laughing, but I haven't thought about Dennis in a while, and he's just the best. That's what I'll say in closing. You know, he was just the best. I miss him dearly.
And that was Tom Robinson. I mean, that was awesome. But the thing that kept getting to me was, like, I didn't ever know Dennis Carluzzo, but I was amazed by that impression. You had to be almost freaking out, I'm guessing.
I'd never heard anyone do an impression of Dennis before, despite the fact that he was so unique and there were so many people around him. I never heard anyone do that. So when Tom started doing that, I took a step back. It brought back so many memories of late night phone calls I would have with Dennis and all the times I spent, not just at his shows, but hanging out at his house with him and his children. And I second what Tom said. I miss Dennis. I think about him all the time. And what a great thought. I think Tom's another guy that we're going to have on the show again to talk about things beyond Dennis, because he was really great there. Really some funny, funny stories.
Yeah, and I mean that benefit show. I mean, it's we talked about it a little. I mean, it's really just just some amazing stuff like that. It was going to be the last ever Midnight Express match, at least, you know, before all the reunions in the 2000s.
Yeah, that's right.
Until Bobby got injured. And, you know, they kind of tied it into the weekend. They did another WWE show that weekend. So they're like, I'm trying to remember. I don't remember which was first, if that show was first or the other show was first. And they did an angle at one to lean to the other with like a contract signing. And so just a lot of cool stuff with a lot of, you know, great talent. Yeah, like you know, we were talking about with it being different, and we'll talk about this more in upcoming weeks. You know, that it's, you've got, that it was like name wrestlers, but still in dream matches and stuff like that. So it's, you know, Eddie Gilbert, Jerry Lawler, in this case, Midnight Express, Cactus Jack, Terry Funk. It's just a very different type of like indie dream match and all that. And then the stuff like that Dennis and Larry Sharp would do, but also that Joel Goodhart would do too. Like your random like 80 stars that never wrestled before, even if it doesn't seem like an amazing match. Like, you know, just all the stuff with guys like Austin Idol and Paul Orndorff and Chris Adams and even Al Perez. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned that this was supposed to be the last Midnight Express match. I believe this is, you know, a month out of their last WCW match, which would have been Halloween Havoc. Yeah. So, I mean, this is right after they came out of WCW. And, you know, Dennis at the time had a good relationship, I believe, with Joel Goodhart. I mean, if you watched the video, which is on YouTube, and we're going to try to get that in the playlist. But you see Joel Goodhart there. You see him in his tuxedo. I mean, he's just such a funny looking guy. You know, he's wearing his sunglasses and his tuxedo indoors at this show. He just looks like a coked up member of the Electric Light Orchestra or something. You know, or he belongs in the Blue Oyster Cult or something. I mean, he's just such a crazy looking character. But this was a real time, especially in that area in South New Jersey and Philadelphia, where you were getting just these indie super shows where all the main guys who weren't wrestling for Vince McMahon or for World Championship Wrestling would get brought in. And it was really the beginning of, you know, I hate to say it was the beginning of the hardcore fan, but it was the beginning of that hardcore style of, you know, indie shows where every match had someone bleeding, where there were brawls all over the building, where you had these dream matches that would, you know, typically only take place in Japan or somewhere.
Right. I mean, it got to overkill with Goodhart, but
yeah, very much so. He couldn't even afford his shows. He was bringing in too many people that he wasn't able to, that he was paying more to bring people in than he was making on the shows.
That's indie wrestling.
Yeah. More to come in the weeks to come about that. I know it's something that you really dig and something I really dig as well.
And also, I'll even give a shout out because he has a lot of this stuff on his own YouTube channel, Rob Russin's stuff with his IWA in Florida. And also, he was involved with the NWF, and I always forget the name of the guy who promoted that. Like, similar stuff in, again, you know, late 80s to early 90s.
You know, same area, too, I think, NWF.
Yeah, NWF was, you know, like a lot of Jersey, South Jersey, Pennsylvania, that type of thing. Also, where I guess the earliest Paul Heyman video footage in pro wrestling comes from.
Yeah, that's right, him interviewing. Yeah,
interviewer and color commentator and stuff. So.
By the way, he was great in that role.
He was actually pretty good doing the interviews and stuff. His commentary was not great yet.
No, but as the interviewer, I thought he was really, really good.
Yeah, he was very good as an interviewer there. And just like, and again, like on Rob's channel, like just to give examples, like he has stuff from like an Australian tour he ran where he has like two different Kamala versus Paul Orndorff matches. And I mean, that's probably nothing, not that much more than just a fun match, but it's still something different.
Right. Right. And yeah, boy, this has been another fun episode, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
Each week it gets crazier and crazier and more fun. And I feel like we're neglecting LP Diaz, I have to say, for our longtime listeners. I feel like Dark Journey kind of pushed LP Diaz to the sidelines, so we need to find a way to get him back involved in the program.
I don't want to know what she pushed him with.
Bix.
Yes?
Remember when Dark Journey threw the ink in Jake the Snake's eyes? That wasn't ink.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to be having Dark Journey on the program anytime soon.
I probably should have no-sold that.
Yeah, you probably should have, but that's okay. That's okay. Well, Bix, I guess it's time for the plugs. Go ahead with your parade of plugs.
Let's see. I don't know if there's that much to talk about this week. I mean, you know, this week's Between the Sheets, we had Rob Naylor on. Talked for way too long about the end of 1986 into the beginning of 1987 and some other stuff that came up after, like because we apparently were not aware of the gay jobber fetish subculture thing.
Yeah, I know nothing about this, and I just started listening to the episode, so I haven't gotten up to that yet. I know you told me that it's mentioned towards the end. I don't know. I don't even understand what that means. So I will be, just like everyone else, listening to that, dying to know what that is all about.
Okay. What?
Gay? What is it? Gay jobber subculture? Is that what you refer
to it
as? I
mean, it's guys who are – I mean, they're into, like, jobber matches, and there's other stuff, too. Like, I mentioned on there, like, the worst thing I've ever seen was a guy who was into the – I believe the term Chris used was muscle bears – and edited, like, they love Jeep Swenson.
I think maybe I should no-sell this.
And there was a guy who, on YouTube, it could even still be there, I don't know, edited clips of the Warlord and Jeep Swenson to make it look like they were fighting each other.
Well, they're not jobbers, though. I mean, that's a little
this different. It's different, but it all kind of comes from the same thread.
Oh, okay. Well, you learn something new every day, especially here on this program. But that's Between the Sheets with David Bixenspan and Chris Zellner. Check
dirt
it out.
Sheet. Dirt sheets. Not any other type of sheets this time, especially.
Yes, between the dirt sheets. good idea to specify that, Bix. But tell us what else you got in terms of your writing, what's out there right now.
You know, Figure Four Weekly, a lot of Hogan Gawker stuff the last few weeks. Got coming up, I feel like I'm still superstitious to say the thing that I've got coming up in a couple weeks until it's a little closer, but everyone will enjoy it. I'm just trying to figure out if there's any way I should tease it.
I think you just did. You just teased it.
Any way to tease it more specifically, but I'll think about that, and we'll talk about that next week, I guess. And Fighting Spirit, I'll have a couple things in the next issue. Don't know if I want to be too specific about it yet, but
yeah, that's okay. But let's talk about the issue that's out now. I mentioned it either last week or the week before. Can't recommend it enough. Bix has a great article about Nick Bockwinkel, and Jim Cornette has a really great article about the end of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. I can't recommend those two articles enough. Check out Fighting Spirit magazine for those two articles alone.
Yeah, and I guess that's about it. I mean, follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Follow Brian on Twitter at Great Brian Last. I mean, also, if you want to support, you know, the show or me or whatever somehow, you know, you can also, you know, use my Amazon, you know, referral thing, which, you know, doesn't cost you anything. You're just going to Amazon, and when you buy something, I get a kickback, which for me, I just have it set up at tinyurl.com/BixAmazon. And I've also got Patreon and PayPal things set up if you want to do any donation for some reason, which are paypal.me or patreon.com/DavidBix.
Yeah, and if you do it for this show, just specify that so I can invoice Bix and make sure I get my fair cut of the prize money. But,
prize money?
Yeah, I'm going to consider it prize money, absolutely.
Okay.
And I guess that's it for this week. We'll have more fun stuff next week, and we hope you enjoyed the show. Please, if there's anything I could ask, please, if you enjoy our program, please give us a rating on iTunes.
Yes. Just
give us hopefully 5 stars.
And
leave a review.
Yeah, leave a review too, et cetera.
That would really help us continue to bring you this program, which we enjoy doing, but that would really, really help us. So if we could ask a favor of you, please do that for us. I'll be your friend. I'll be your best friend. And that's it for this week. Right, Bix?
Yes. Tally-ho.
Tally-ho!
This is WWE President Dennis Carluzzo, and I'm here at the Hall of Records in Philadelphia to prove what Chris Candido has been saying all along, that Tracy Smothers is really Vito Marinara from Schuylkill Haven, PA. An associate of mine is now right in the hall at this time copying the birth certificate. He should be here very shortly. Alfonso, you keep that camera on. I paid you for the whole hour. Hey, Vinny, you got the merchandise.
Jeez, thanks. Slap time. easy to pick like they used to be.
Is that a camera roll?
Hey, don't worry, don't worry. Here we go, people. Living proof that Tracy Smothers is really not from Tennessee, right here in black and white.
Dennis, got my patchouli?
How much are you, Vinny?
$50.
$50?
$50.
You gotta be kidding, Vinny. What are you busting my chops for? I've been good to you all for a long time. You're trying to fleece me. What's the deal here?